Charlotte 06.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Attention deficit disorder may be a byproduct of nature deficit disorder. At least that's the theory proposed by our guest this hour. Richard Louv coined that term in his book, Last Child in the Woods. After spending 10 years traveling through America talking to parents and children, he discovered that the media has literally scared children out of the out-of-doors. Today, they spend their time inside, connected to many things, including video games and computers, but not to nature. And that lack of connection to nature is helping to give rise to obesity, depression, and yes, attention deficit disorder. Richard Louv is on a crusade to reverse that trend, and that has brought him to Charlotte and to us. Thank you for being here this morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
I mentioned that you traveled the country in advance of this book for about, what, how long? 10 years, did I say? Something like that? Talking to parents and to children. Did you set out to prove a hypothesis that you'd already arrived at, that children were disconnected, it was leading to all these problems, or did you uncover that in the course of these travels and conversations?
It actually began with the research for a prior book that was published in 1990 called Childhood's Future. And for that book, I interviewed about 3,000 parents and kids and tried to stay away from experts all across the country. And what I was doing is going into classrooms and living rooms with my tape recorder and asking primarily parents, but also kids, how is childhood changing? How is family life changing at that point? The old rule book had been thrown out. There wasn't a new one. And I was looking for the repeating themes. And believe me, it's not a good way to research a book because you come back with 10,000 pages of transcripts. Literally, it was about that. But I was looking for the repeating themes. And this issue of this strange discomfort with something profound was changing in the relationship between children and nature kept coming up, even with children who would watch television. They'd watch Lassie, the old show on TV, mm-hmm. and they'd say, you know, that looks like Martians, because the kids would go out and build their treehouse, and they'd go wander into the swamp, and, you know, Jeff and Porky would have these adventures, and that looked very strange to them. So even then, in the late 80s, it was occurring. So I wrote a chapter about that in Childhood's Future, and that was picked up by Sierra Magazine and Utney Reader. But there wasn't much research then. And so for the next decade, I kept writing about that now and then. During that decade, two sets of research began to emerge. One was showing that there was this deficit happening, that kids weren't going outside, hardly any, compared to prior generations. The second set of research was connecting this to child obesity, to attention deficit disorder, but in a way that was saying that nature has these wonderful gifts to give kids. Why are we taking these gifts away from them?
Are we taking them away, or are they simply not interested in receiving them?
Well, the biophilia hypothesis, E.O. Wilson at Harvard talks about this, that we're all hardwired as a species to need nature, to love nature. This is in us. This is part of our humanity. And it will come back very quickly. You'll see that even kids that haven't been in nature at all, once they have some experience in it, it's like riding a bike. But what we've done is, we've scared kids right out of the woods. I mean, the news media, and I've been a journalist for a long time. I like to think it's not us print guys, but all you have to do is watch CNN or Fox, and you'll see how they take a handful of terrible crimes against children and repeat them over and over and over again. That's the very definition of conditioning. The actual statistics on stranger danger don't bear up. I mean, we're not. I'm not saying there's not risk out there, but it's not nearly what people think it is. But in addition to that, there is the issue of the electronic world and 44 hours a week spent plugged into some kind of electronic medium for kid. That's a factor. Also, the over-organization of childhood. I mean, good parents feel they have to get their kids in 24, hours a day of enrichment. Mm-hmm. So they get them in Suzuki violin lessons, and they're taking them to soccer, et cetera. So the kids' hours are taken up. So there's no time for independent play, let alone getting out into nature to do that. So that's disappeared as well.
Parents are certainly been scared about the safety of kids playing alone. I mean, when I was a kid, I would disappear in the morning and come back at dinner time, and only because if I didn't come back at dinner time, I would catch it. Otherwise, I'd be out there probably well after dark. And no one seemed to care. And now that's unheard of for kids. The parents have been scared, but have the kids been scared? Are kids afraid of the woods? Are they afraid of being outside alone by themselves with no Game Boys, etc.?
A lot of them are afraid of being dirty.
Really?
Dirty. Yeah. Yeah, and I, oddly enough, and this is anecdotal, there's no research.
Mom must love that.
Yeah, no, hey, it's anecdotal that actually I keep hearing that from parents that the boys are now the ones that are more scared of getting dirty than the girls. I don't know if that's true, but I hear that a lot. But they are also scared of nature. I mean, some of the nature centers or the nature preserves, the buses will pull up for those schools that still have field trips and take mm-hmm. the kids out there. You know, the first question the kids ask is, where are the lions? Where are the tigers? There is this permeating, generalized fear that is rooted in a fear of strangers, but that branches out into fear of nature itself.
Wow. You say that kids have the outdoors has become kind of an abstract to them, even as mm-hmm. the internet and television has opened their world up to things that my generation probably never had access to, except on black and white, and that's not real. It's become an abstraction to them, but they sit there and watch it, and they're fascinated by mm-hmm. it. So why doesn't that propel them to their own adventures outdoors, looking for turtles? And
well, that's interesting, because I had a long talk with the head of Sesame Workshop, Sesame Street,
mm-hmm.
and I think that, yeah, there are shows about nature, and they're terrific shows. I mean, but that is secondhand. That is a secondary experience. And we have a lot of programs about nature and a lot of programs of adults, wrestling adults, we have that too, wrestling alligators. I mean, we have a lot of that. What we don't have is modeling behavior. We don't have television shows that show kids going outside and making a treehouse. And one of the things I suggested to Sesame Street is, why don't we have a television show called This Old Treehouse and have kids run the TV show and show them making their own, not their dad making it, but them making it out of old boards, et cetera, and then having that be kind of a place that they branch out to go look for box turtles.
There needs to be a remake of Swiss Family Robinson, perhaps.
Yeah. Part of the good news of the kind of the movement that has emerged since the book came out, and it is impressive what's happened in the last few years, is that Sesame Street this year, for the first time in 40 years, because of this movement, is changing its set. And we'll have nature on the set for the first time in 40 years, and they're going to make a theme of that for a year.
Were you surprised the impact that this book and your trips around the country talking about this have had?
Sure, yeah. And I'm going to get a T-shirt that says, "Who knew?" but no, and it's and one of the reasons I'm here in Charlotte is because the Carolina Thread, the Catawba Land Conservancy, the whole idea that this isn't just something we can shame parents about at all. Parents don't need to be shamed about anything, related to this.
Mm-hmm.
They're scared. They're, and not only that, but urban design has made it almost impossible for a lot of kids to get outdoors. It's not only the physical design of our cities and neighborhoods; it's the legal design. I mean, almost every housing development's built in the last 30 years is controlled by covenants and restrictions, CC&Rs. You look at those, just try to build a treehouse, let alone. Just try to put up a basketball hoop, let alone let the kids build a treehouse. One woman told me that her community association had outlawed chalk drawing on the sidewalks, which I guess leads to cocaine,
Yes.
But I mean,
I got to tell you, I live in a neighborhood where the kids do that. They chalk draw on the street, and I hadn't been in a neighborhood like that since I was a kid, and that was a long time ago. And it shocked me I walked out of the house to get the paper one morning, and because I'd come home after dark the night before, and there were these. It was the whole map of the city on in chalk on the street where South Park was and where downtown was, and nights at the stadiums were, etc. And it shocked me. I thought, hooligans. And then I thought, no, these are just kids. And it's chalk. It'll wash away. Yeah, but you call this the criminalization of the outdoors, essentially.
Yeah, of natural play, of nature play, or just any kind.
How did we reach that? What is wrong with a parent putting up a basketball hoop at the edge of the driveway or a treehouse in the backyard if they have a tree big enough to support it?
Look, every time I think I've heard of the most egregious example of this, I hear another one, and I think it was South Carolina. I heard a father came up and said that his community association decided there were too many flower pots in front of the houses, so they came up with a regulation that said you could only have 3 flower pots, and they could only be 10 inches across. You know, flower pots, the enemy within. You know, we've got to stop them at the border. This is, what are we thinking? I mean, what are we thinking when schools, in Florida, there's a huge school district. They started putting up no running signs on the playgrounds. What are we thinking? And then we wonder, then we hand out brochures to parents about child obesity.
Yeah. How did we get here? Do you know?
Well, I think a number of things. I think fear is at the core of this, the urge to control our lives, which is understandable when we feel things are out of control. But that's been building since the 70s. I think also we have devalued nature as an experience. We've made it into an abstract experience. Somehow the culture has done that. But when you begin to look at this literature, the research that's coming out, and parents are learning how great this is for their kids, and they're starting to figure this out. And so are the organizations like the land conservancies. Here in North Carolina and South Carolina, there's a lot going on there, too. You've already got WNC Kids and Nature Lovers. You got Discover the World Outside in North Carolina. You got Take a Child Outside Day, which is now started by Liz Baird in North Carolina. That has branched out, and they're all over the country now. People are taking kids outside on this particular day in September.
So if this began happening in the 70s, I'm trying to do the timeline here. If this began happening in the 70s, it's us. It's the boomers that have done this. It's the kids who grew up in the 50s and 60s who had free range, pretty much. I mean, I had free range.
Yeah.
We just disappeared, went into the woods, roller skated down the street, beyond the horizon. It took bicycles beyond the horizon for hours on end. It's us. Why did our generation, who wanted to break all the conventions in the world, become the one that clamps down on everything?
It's a great question. I don't have an answer. I don't know. I'm a baby boomer, and I think it's...
We survived the free range.
You know, I think maybe a lot of it came oddly out of a generation that was cause-oriented and concerned about the welfare of children and, you know, all of those things. But we kind of overdid it. And, I like to think that our generation was a cause-oriented generation. Yeah. And this may be our most redemptive cause.
You know? Richard Louv is the author of Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. We'll talk about exactly what nature deficit disorder means when we come back from the break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for this rebroadcast edition of Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the U.S. National Whitewater Center's 4th of July Festival, featuring live music from Bruce Hornsby and the Noisemakers and Mo, plus fireworks on July 3rd and 4th. Details at usnwc.org. Coming up Monday on Charlotte Talks, many Americans take issue with a theory of evolution, insisting it is, after all, simply a theory. Worse, it's at odds with the Bible. These folks believe in intelligent design, an idea that appalls evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins. And he argues his point of view in The Greatest Show on Earth, The Evidence for Evolution, his book. We'll revisit our 2009 conversation with him when Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Mm-hmm.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. The Supreme Court rules that police need a warrant to search a cell phone. House Speaker John Boehner says he will file suit against President Obama, accusing him of abuse of executive power. And what we learned from Tuesday's primaries.
Join the Diane Rehm Show in the News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Richard Louv, author of Last Child in the Woods, and the person who's responsible almost single-handedly for bringing up the fact that we don't let children be children anymore, and we have disconnected them from the out-of-doors, from nature. And you coined the term nature deficit disorder. What did you mean by that?
Well, in Last Child in the Woods, that idea was in the book, mm-hmm. and my publisher is actually in North Carolina. It's Algonquin out of New York in Chapel Hill, and the publisher convinced me to, and I resisted this, which shows you what I know about marketing. They wanted nature deficit disorder in the subtitle on the cover, and boy, am I glad they did that, because the phrase has entered the language. It was in the book, but I didn't want it on the cover. They convinced me, and it's entered the language, and people know exactly what they mean, what it is. And it's not a known medical disorder, and I make that very clear several times in the book. It is, however, a way to describe something that many of us have felt in the back of our mind was happening.
There's another phrase that I ran across in reading about all this in the last couple of days, and that is no child left inside. That is not yours, though, is it?
No. Actually, their first program that was called No Child Left Inside was in Connecticut, which mm-hmm. was an effort to get kids back into the state parks, and that was several years ago. I started using that phrase around then and in speeches and on radio interviews and all that, and that also has caught on. In fact, there is now national legislation called the No Child Left Inside Act.
Yeah, wow.
And that's being considered. It was passed, actually, by the House last year, but it's back in the House and the Senate now.
We talked a little bit about parental fears driving some of this, and because of what they hear in the news about child abductions and just general safety or lack of safety for children out there in the big, bad world. But most of us, most of these parents, I would think, at least, well, maybe not. Maybe the contemporary parents today did not play outdoors. Young parents today probably didn't play outdoors because we started this. The boomers started this back in the 70s. So we're two generations removed now from playing outdoors. But at the same time, the crime rates against children have dropped precipitously.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we tend to want to believe the bad news that we hear, these incidences where there really are horrific things happening to kids, as opposed to all the good things that aren't happening? I mean, the fact that the crime rate has dropped. Why don't we believe that and go with that?
Well, you ever watch Nancy Grace? You know?
I try not to, whenever possible.
you know, what we didn't have was this nonstop drumbeat of the 24-hour news cycle being conditioned to live in a state of fear.
We do live in a state of fear. Yeah. Everything about the country lives in a state of fear constantly.
Yeah. And some people think this is some kind of conspiracy. I actually hear this, and I don't believe that because that would, you know, credit our profession of journalism with too much institutional intelligence. Mm. But, you know, it's not that. But it just permeates the country now. And I want to make clear, I'm not saying there's no risk out there. There is risk from strangers, some risk. There is risk from danger, some risk. I know I collected copperheads when I was a kid. There's some risk. That's part of its attraction. But we need to begin to think, both legally and in our own lives, in terms of comparative risk. There's risk out there from nature itself. Yeah. But there's also a huge risk in raising a generation and future generations of children under virtual protective house arrest.
Why?
A risk to their psychological health, a risk to their physical health. Want a real risk? Look at child obesity. Pediatricians are now saying this generation of kids may be the first to die at an earlier age than their own parents in terms of life expectancy.
Because of heart disease, diabetes.
Yeah, because of this sedentary lifestyle, right. I mean, they no longer call it adults onset diabetes because kids get it now.
Yeah.
And a lot of kids get it now. So those are real risks, a risk to our sense of connection to community. I mean, this has something to do with our democracy, too. Believe it or not, to have a sense of community, you have to go out the front door. You have to know people. You have to know your neighborhood. You have to know nature in order to love it. A risk to the future of the earth itself, or at least our relationship to it. The studies show almost to a person, conservationists had some extraordinary experience in nature when they were kids. What happens if that virtually ends? We'll still have environmentalists, but they'll carry the nature in their briefcases, not in their hearts.
Given the trend that we're talking about here, how did you avoid being caught up in it? Why are you out there crusading for a different way?
That's a good question. I think when I was a kid, like a lot of folks, I had an intense sense that nature, that my time in the woods was, saving me in some way. And there were reasons for that. But, I never lost that.
Hmm. So. Despite the risks and despite your advocacy of going back and pushing kids back outdoors, essentially, you are not advocating a return to what you call the free-range childhood of the 1950s. I grew up in that childhood. I'm just curious as to why you're not advocating for that.
Well, partly it's realism. The days of telling your kids, go outside, don't come back in until the streetlights come on, are in most neighborhoods probably not going to come back tomorrow in time for this generation of kids.
Could they? I mean, is it safe for that to happen?
In some neighborhoods, probably, yeah. But I think that, I think we have to be realistic about and respect the fear that parents do feel, even if a lot of that fear is being conditioned to feel. So what are we going to do about that then? I think that good people, good adults need to take kids outdoors. And they need to learn to do it in a way where they're not hovering over them in the woods with nature flashcards, but that they're actually letting these kids dig a hole, have these kids...
And get cuts and scrapes,
right,
and bruises.
And invent their own play. I mean, the studies of self-regulation of children, it's called executive function of brain in brain development. You actually have to make up your own play to develop that. Hmm. And what are we doing? We're scripting everything.
Well, yeah. Kids today, as you've already mentioned, are very regimented. They get outside because they do soccer practice from 1 to 2 and then softball practice from 2:30 to 3:30, and then they might go to ballet class or some other kind of class. But every minute of their day is taken up with this regimented stuff.
And that's understandable. Look, parents are trying to be good parents,
right,
and that's understandable. But when parents start to learn about the fact that learning outside, I'm going to write a column someday called "Want Your Kid to Get into Harvard? Tell Them to Go Outside," because the literature that's emerging on this is so impressive in terms of schools that get kids outside. The test scores go up, and yet what do? You know, we cut recess, we cut field trips, we build schools, or at least we used to starting in the 70s with no windows. What are we thinking?
Yeah. When kids have no experience outside, when their experience with nature is through a screen, and when most of the fun that they have is with their PlayStations and Wiis and things like that, they go outside and they're bored. There's nothing to do. There's nothing to stimulate them. It's just a tree and grass and dirt and a ditch, and it's just there's nothing to do. And a lot of these kids don't have what I had was a big woods in the back of my house, which it's still there today. And when I look at it today, it's tiny, but it seemed limitless when I was a kid. It went on forever, and we pretended it was the forest primeval, and Robin Hood was out there. Kids today, if they have that, they're lucky, but most of them don't. They live in these cul-de-sac neighborhoods, and adjacent to their backyard is somebody else's backyard on the other cul-de-sac. What do they do? How do they learn to do things outdoors?
You're bringing up several issues. All of them are very real. Urban design is part of this, or the neighborhood design is part of this. One of the reasons that the Carolina Thread Trail is so important is because it's recognizing that You know, design does have something to do with this, that urban design, you know, how can kids go out and play in nature if there is no real nature, or if there are signs on the grass that say, get off the grass?
That's right. In
fact, we were talking a little bit before the show, some of the folks involved with the Carolina Thread, which I spoke last night to the folks that are supporting that. It is such a great idea, this interconnected trail that goes through, I think, 15 counties?
I think so. I'm not 15 counties.
But I was thinking about, you know, neighborhoods that still have that lot that kids can go out and play in, they still, or that little, the woods that you just right. described, which is actually very small and not biodiverse and not consequential in terms of biology, and yet to a child it can be the doorway into nature, yeah. their first doorway. Very important for kids. Those places are. So what if, one of the things I've thought about is, what if neighborhoods could get a little packet, a little toolkit on how they could create their own neighborhood land trust to protect that little place so that nobody's going to care about. Big land conservancies, they got their hands full. But what if a neighborhood could say, you know, we want to preserve that, not only for our kids, but the kids that will come later. Mm-hmm. And they just did that on that little piece of, in the Carolinas, perhaps along with the Carolina Thread Trail, Carolina Thread, mm-hmm. you call those little places Carolina Buttons. You could have button parks that neighborhoods themselves would preserve as natural places for kids to play.
Okay. So we have some folks who have emailed us and gotten on Facebook, et cetera, which I'll share with you in a second. Jeff, who identifies himself as being from the U.S. National Whitewater Center, so it must be Jeff Wise. Is that right?
It is. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome.
Hey, wanted to tell you one of the things that's really interesting that tracks with what Richard's saying that we find out here in our experiences, and that is, you know, we've got 400 acres of woods with, you know, creeks and rivers and everything running through the place. And, you know, the routine we get is, you know, the parents say to us all the time, you know, there's nothing out there for the kids to do. And it just, there's nothing that riles us, you know, quicker and probably more passionately than that, where we're saying, folks, this is what we're all about. It's about getting people outside again. And what we're finding is, unless we program it, that people really don't see the opportunity.
Are you familiar with this place, the U.S. National Whitewater Center? It's the largest facility of its kind in the country. It is a great big rapid that they can control. It's a man-made rapid that they can control. But in addition to that, they have climbing facilities. They have bike trails. They have, do you have canoeing? Don't you have canoeing as well?
We do.
Okay.
But,
all kinds of things to do. And he's being told that there's nothing for the kids to do.
Enormous place. One of the kind of central paradoxes of this issue, and certainly it's a paradox that runs throughout Last Child in the Woods, and I struggled with it in the book, which is that because of the fear that people feel, and because they've been disconnected from nature for a while, parents, the reality is exactly what the caller is talking about, and that is also combined with the sense of fear, that in order to give kids some semblance of unorganized experience in nature, we're going to probably have to organize a lot of it. I mean, it's just an irony we're going to have to live with a sense of humor and do our best and not hover over them with nature flashcards. But, this thing about there's nothing to do out there. I spoke at a high school a couple years ago, and about 200 kids. I expected 20, and there were 200. They gave them extra credit. And the biology teacher who had invited me gave these kids an assignment a couple weeks later, these high school kids, to go out and spend just a half hour in nature, and they could define what nature was. Go spend a half hour, write a one-page essay, and bring it back. He gave me the essays. They were amazing. They said, now, I need to precede this by saying, I would talk to them about the full use of their senses mm-hmm. and the connection of nature experience to their health. But the fact is that other than the New York subway, when else do you use all of your senses at the same time as when you're outdoors in nature? And so I'd already talked to those kids about that. They went out. These essays said, I saw things I'd never seen before. I heard things I'd never heard before. One boy said, I could smell the beauty. They said that they were going to do this again. There was a theme that ran through these essays that was that they came back feeling better than when they had left. to go to that place. You know, these were amazing essays, and this was a half hour of experience.
Yeah.
There's a theory in child development called the loose parts theory in play. The more loose parts there are, the more creative the play. You don't get any more loose parts than you do out in the woods or in a field or along a stream.
Because it's completely disorganized, nature.
Well, that's a philosophical question. It's organized in a way that is infinite in its possibilities.
Right. Yeah. Jeff, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm going to go to Chatham in Charlotte. Welcome, Chatham.
Good morning, gentlemen. Rich, I just want to commend you. You're just doing such a fine job. You know, I have a little theory about this. Living in the two-dimensional world, as we all tend to do way, way, way too much today, computers, TV, whatever, it's all so two-dimensional. If you're outside, you're in a three-dimensional world, you're using those senses like you're talking about, and, you know, it leads to more three-dimensional thinking. Now, I'm just curious whether or not, you know, you see this as a positive thing, being able to walk around a problem and look at it from all its sides as opposed to just looking at it two-dimensionally. That's where, you know, we're talking about cognitive ability and being outside and how important that is. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, the studies that are showing the increase in cognitive abilities and learning, the ability to learn, are very impressive. And by the way, the Last Child in the Woods has a new section at the back of it. It's an updated version, the 2008 version, mm-hmm. that has 100 actions that people can take, including teachers. One of the things I'm the chairman of the Children and Nature Network. One of the things that we're going to start is what we call the Natural Teachers Network. Mm-hmm. And you can go to the website, childrenandnature.org, and sign up as a teacher now. The idea there being it's not just environmental educators. It's that art teacher out there that insists on getting kids outdoors. It's the, you know, it's the English teacher or the literature teacher takes them out to write poetry under the tree. Those teachers have been working hard to get their kids outdoors. Oftentimes they have to fight their administration to do it because of the emphasis on testing, et cetera. It's discouraged. Those teachers are heroes, and nobody really talks about them, the mm-hmm. ones that take the kids outdoors that aren't necessarily environmental educators. We want to encourage that.
Judy writes, I am a science elementary education professor at Belmont Abbey College, and I thank you for your book. I use it in my class, and many of my lessons encourage outdoor study. My student teachers are teaching science and encouraging outdoor play and study. You write about actually teaching outdoors.
Yeah, and that's not just to learn about nature. Learning in nature is, you know, part of the deal here. It's just you can learn about anything better in nature when you're outdoors.
I'm going to ask you why that is. We have to take a break, and when we come back, I'll ask you why, and we'll also go back to our phones since we have a full bank of phone calls and a raft of emails and Facebook comments and questions, etc. Our guest today, Richard Louv, author of Last Child in the Woods. We're back in just about a minute and a half on WFAE Charlotte Talks.
Support for this rebroadcast edition of Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds, serving Charlotte for over 30 years with fine diamonds, engagement rings, custom design, and jewelry for all occasions. Now at our new Charlotte location, Moorcroft Village, and DonaldHack.com. Coming up next in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the national news hour of the Diane Rehm Show's News Roundup. The panel will discuss the week's top national headlines, including the Supreme Court handing down key rulings, House Speaker John Boehner saying he'll file suit against President Barack Obama, accusing him of abuse of executive power, and what we learned from Tuesday's primaries. The Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock here on 90.7 WFAE.
You don't like your job, you quit. Well, in normal times.
The last recession actually frightened the workforce. You're not going to take the chance of moving your whole family for a new job unless you believe it's going to stick.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Quitting and what it can tell us about the economy we live in. That's next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Richard Louv, author of A Last Child in the Woods. Just for the break, you talked about how you can learn everything better outdoors in nature. I remember the first good day of spring every year. We all clamored to be taught outdoors. And sometimes the teacher would take us outdoors. We'd sit under a tree or something like that. And she'd teach grammar or she'd teach whatever it was she was teaching. And we loved that. It probably doesn't happen very much today if kids don't want to go outdoors. But why is it that you can learn better if you're outdoors?
You know, this is a terribly under-researched topic. The whole issue of the relationship between human beings in general, particularly children, and nature is under-researched. Great research question. You know, there are theories about that in terms of the full use of the senses. I mean, when you're using all of your senses at the same time, you're really in the optimum state of learning. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's some things that are better taught indoors, like interior decorating. But on the other hand, you know, maybe going outside would probably help with that.
I remember when I was in college on the first day of Rice Knife's Day of Spring, we had a window in the radio station, and we would literally take the microphone outside, have somebody else run the controls, and we'd sit out there and do the show outdoors because it was nice to be outside.
Yeah. You know, I take that back about interior decorating because, part the cutting edge of green architecture now is something called biophilic design.
Uh-huh.
And what they're finding is that workplaces, for instance, that are designed with nature in the design from the beginning and then kept there in the building as well as outside, the productivity of the workers goes up.
Wow.
So, you know, maybe we do need to go outside to learn interior decorating.
Let's go outside on our phone to Lynn in Concord. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much. Couple of comments. Number one, I think as parents, we do not need to schedule our children for so many activities after school and on Saturdays, beginning at the age of two. I think we definitely do just need to take our children out to a park, greet and meet our neighbors, see who is around our community. I think that supports families and children just growing up. The second thing, I think, is our education system has definitely let us down. I know that one of my children has PE once every 7 days.
Hmm. Yeah.
Children do not know how to go outside and play tag. They don't know how to go outside and play ball. And third is just basically what you were talking about. I have two other children in a charter school, and thankfully they have PE three times a week, and their science class, before they even open a book, actually go outside and dig in the dirt and make topical graphs, learn the different layers of what's in the earth, and then go back to the classroom, talk about what they did outside, and then open up the textbook. So, it is a wonderful way for them to learn.
So kids have been disconnected from all the games that they used to play outside because they haven't played outside in 20 years or 30 years or so. Have they also been disconnected from understanding how to just make things up?
Yeah, I mean, teachers talk about that a lot. The lost ability to visualize is a real issue. To make up your own play rather than having it scripted for you. This is really important in terms of child development. One of the things, and the caller alludes to this, is, you know, it's about adults too. It's about socialization. We suffer as adults from nature deficit disorder too. The good news here is, though, that any adult who in a positive way takes a child outside to experience nature gets all the same benefits immediately. There's over 100 studies that show for adults, stress reduction is terrific if you go outdoors just for a walk in the woods. You know, the attention deficit disorder, you know, a lot of adults have problems with attention themselves, and this tends to increase your ability to pay attention to go outdoors. So we have to actually come up with kind of new ways to do this, too. One of the things that we're hoping that people will go to the Children in Nature Network website or to another terrific website called Nature Rots naturerocks.org, where they can download free toolkits on how to create their own family nature club. And that idea comes from a parent in Roanoke, Virginia, who a couple years ago emailed me and said that he and his wife had read the book. They started getting their kids outdoors on weekends, all of them as a family. One day the five-year-old says, "Dad, how come we're the only family having this much fun?" He started turning to other families. Today he's got almost 400 families on his email list. What they do is they arrange nature play dates, essentially, among four, five, six families, agree to meet at the park on Saturday and go for a hike. That kind of idea needs to spread. What if there were thousands of those kinds of nature clubs, family nature clubs around the country? What if they spread?
Aren't the Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts? I mean,
no. These are ones that people can do now and for themselves. They don't have to wait for an organization. They don't have to wait for funding. They can do it.
Okay.
At that point, you know, we would have really deep cultural change beginning.
Let me go to Hendersonville. Sandra, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I see this as I'm a both mental health professional, a former teacher with an early childhood major, and a mental health professional. And I see this with three components, really. One is the issue of how we parent and grandparent today. Parents, in large part, have abdicated the parenting role to coaches and teachers. And I think the points you've made about the benefit to the adults of getting outside is huge. I also think the mental health issue, we all know that the best remedy for depression is not medication. It's activity, walking, hiking, swimming, whatever it is. And the other academic thing that you addressed about if you want to get into Harvard, go outside, I think that's beautiful. And my grandson, who I'm raising, a 9-year-old grandson, is a rock hound, and he's about to drive me nuts with all the piles of rocks that come into the house. But I'm taking him down to our local gem and mineral museum, and I guess I'm going to be the one that organizes a junior rock hound club there. So I think there are so many components to this. I'm thrilled to learn of your book. I don't have a TV at my house. And my grandson never says, "I'm bored, what am I going to do?" He has director sets, Legos, books, puzzles, all kinds of stuff. So there are ways to do this that you are pointing out that are free, available 24/7, 365.
And there are, you know, I want to make sure I correct something that I may have been misleading. I think the Boy Scouts are terrific. Girl Scouts are terrific.
Right.
They've been out there doing this all along. They can do it even more. But there are other organizations. The Sierra Club has Building Bridges to the Outdoors, which gets kids outdoors in all kinds of ways, including in the inner cities. The Sierra Club also has the Military Families Outdoors Program, which is going a long way toward the mental health issues, the physical health for military families, the service people coming back, and they've got kids, and they take them outdoors. For part of it is for their own healing.
Sandra, thank you for your call. You talk about something in your book, The Last Child in the Woods, called the Third Frontier, which is where you say we are today. We've moved in the last 100 years to this third frontier where we are detached from our food origins. There's a disappearing line between humans and machines and animals, and increasingly intellectual only understanding of our relationship with other animals. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I talk about four frontiers. One is the first frontier, which was the real one when people actually wrestled grizzly bears, etc. The second frontier was kind of the Teddy Roosevelt era, in which they still did some of that, but there was a love for nature, almost a romanticization of it. Third frontier is where we're at today, as you said, in which nature becomes an abstraction. We're not even sure we know the definition of life now with nanotechnology, etc. The fourth frontier is the one I want to see now. It's the one that Thomas Berry from North Carolina, the late Thomas Berry, the eco-theologian, talked about a lot. In many ways, which is the idea that the fourth frontier is when we reconnect to the natural world as a place that gives us meaning, that we've lost contact with that. Thomas Berry said that there were two places that, human beings get their sense of meaning, basically. One is their religious text, and one is the universe itself, nature. Mm-hmm. And in the 20th century, we lost touch with nature. In the 21st century, he felt, and he just died recently at the age of, I think, 93, yeah, wonderful guy. The 21st century, which he preferred talking about, is about our reconnection to a sense of meaning that we gain from the universe itself.
A couple of emails I'll share with you here. Ernie in Charlotte writes, now that you have been speaking to people across the country, tell us some of the specific successful programs that you have seen getting kids outdoors that we might be able to model in this area.
A lot of these are, you know, the father that I talked about from Roanoke, Virginia, that came up with this idea for his Family Nature Club, mm-hmm. and that's spreading quickly. That's something people can go out and do. I think here in Charlotte, in this part of the Carolinas, the Carolina Thread Trail is a successful idea. The Take a Child Outside week day is a successful idea. That's out of North Carolina. There are developers that are starting to think this through. Clint Eastwood invited some of the biggest developers in California to meet with me in Carmel a couple of years ago, talk about how can you build developments in the future that actually connect kids to nature. Preferably those would be redeveloping decaying areas of existing cities. But so there's developers interested in this. Things are in Illinois, this happened quite recently. The governor of Illinois, the new one, not the guy they ran out of town, but the new one, his first press conference, the first day as governor, first press conference said, you know, one of the things my predecessor did I didn't like was he shut down a bunch of state parks. He says, but I've been reading this book about nature deficit disorder. And it wasn't just because he was reading this book, by the way. There's also the No Child Left Inside campaign. There's over 60 urban state and province campaigns, regional campaigns to get kids outdoors that have emerged just in the last 3 years in North America. Chicago has one of them, so he knew there was a constituency. So 2 weeks later, he said, you know, no child in Illinois should have nature deficit disorder. No child in Illinois should be left inside. And I am going to reopen 6 state parks, which he did. So things are happening all over the country.
Just so people get an idea of what you're really talking about here, how bad the problem is, in 2007, you wrote an article for Orion Magazine in which you stated that in a typical week, only 6% of children ages 9 to 13 play outside on their own. Does that figure hold up to that?
The figures on that are complex. Okay. And if that was in Orion, I don't think that was in the actual article. I think that was in the reporting of it, okay, of the article.
I'll have to look at my material.
I think the statistics are impressive, are depressing.
Yeah.
They come from a number of different directions.
Okay.
This is an under-researched arena. We need a lot more research.
Let's go to Amanda, who is with North Carolina Outward Bound. Hi.
Hi. How are y'all doing?
Good.
Good. Thanks. Well, we have an interesting perspective. We take students and give them kind of a cold turkey immersion into the wilderness. They go out into the mountains or some other wilderness area for 4 days up to 72 days. And it's really remarkable to see their perspective on the natural world change in that time, even if it's just for a 4-day period. I've talked with students that I'm recruiting to go on an Outward Bound course, and they ask questions like, well, are there going to be bugs? Are there going to be animals? Is it going to rain on us? And they ask these questions as if it would be the most horrible, uncomfortable situation. And then they return from having been outside for, you know, consecutive days and nights, and their perspective is completely different. They see themselves as being part of the natural world, and going outside in the rain or if it's hot or if there are mosquitoes, it's not a big deal to them anymore. So I think a lot of the challenge we have is just breaking down this mindset that the outdoors are uncomfortable so that they can be physically uncomfortable. And I think it's very important that parents teach the children that it's okay to be a little physically uncomfortable. It's okay to get bug bites and get wet and that sort of thing.
You know, if your only exposure to the outdoors is watching Survivor on television, you might never go outdoors again. Those people are miserable.
That's true. That's true. One of the things that I hear from parents also is that, you know, when they do try to get their kids in the back seat and they drive them to the state park or the national park or whatever, and the kids moan and groan the whole way, you know, they're miserable and they get out there and, oh my gosh, years pass. And then the kids come home from college and they say to their parents, remember that time we went to the state park? Wasn't that awesome when we went camping? And the parents wanted to strangle these kids because at the time the kids made them feel like they were torturing them. But you know, but that's the thing they remember. They don't remember the time they scored really well on Nintendo. They remember that experience with their parents.
I have 15 seconds here. What's at stake here? What happens if we don't change?
I think we lose our, to some degree, our connection with the earth itself, our connection with meaning from the universe. I think we place our kids and ourselves at great risk, physical risk, and psychological risk, and spiritual risk.
Richard Louv, author of Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. Thanks for being here.
Charlotte.